Okay, so I am going to... I'll back that up. This is going to be a bit different from what I might normally do in a church service, because I always feel like at church we gather to open the Bible and to hear the Bible read and to explore it together. Whereas this particular topic, I don't know, I did a big search in the Bible for all the references to the internet and to being distracted, screens, you know, all that kind of stuff, and there's not a lot there. So I am going to get to the Bible, but I thought I'd begin more seminar-ish by just throwing a bunch of kind of random, they're not random, sorry, carefully selected ideas along a theme, but they are standalone kind of ideas, which help us to kind of get a bit of a fix on thinking about the age of distraction that we find ourselves in, and then seek to kind of bring a Christian response to that. Does that make sense? So they may sound, it may be like they're just coming at you. Just strap yourself in. Let me throw a bunch of ideas at you and see if together this doesn't kind of coalesce into a particular direction. So here's the first idea I wanted to mention to you. And don't worry about the slides. It doesn't look like that's kind of working or anything, does it? Is it? Yeah, there's that. Is the next one? Good. So the first idea I want to throw at you is the idea of excarnation. And I don't feel bad if you've never heard that word before, because it's very rarely used these days. But we Christians use a word that's quite similar to that, don't we? So you might be, obviously, I hope you are familiar with the Christian idea of incarnation. The incarnation, we say, is God taking on flesh and dwelling among us. So excarnation is just the opposite of that. It's the removal of flesh. So this particular talk starts with some really squeamish kind of ideas, but to excarnate someone is to remove their flesh. And it used to be, not the most common, but a way in which certain cultures and civilizations have actually disposed of dead bodies. So they remove the flesh and only bury the bones. So the Hawaiians, for example, did this. So do you remember when Captain Cook got killed by the Hawaiians? And then when the British went back and said, could we have Captain Cook back? They had to give him back in bits because they were excarnating him as the British came back after him. The pictures on the screen are from Isbista in the island of Orkney in north of Scotland. And this picture on your left is the Isbista tomb of the eagles. When first uncovered by archaeologists, they found hundreds and hundreds of interred skeletons all lined up inside these tombs. And what they figured out is that the way the Orkney Islanders would dispose of their loved ones was to lie them out on a shale bench, as you can see in the other picture there, and the eagles would pick their bones clean, and then they would inter the bones in the tomb. I told you it was squeamish to start with. It's like disgusting, isn't it? But for them, this was like an honourable way to dispose of their dearly departed. And the reason why they figure that's the case is because the bones are all clean, there is no clothing, there's nothing inside the tomb except skeletons, and the bones are all scored or marked as though they'd been pecked at by eagles. So that's the way that term would normally get utilised in normal conversation, although I can't imagine how you would have a conversation about excarnation, but that's literally what excarnation means. But a guy called Charles Taylor, in a book called The Secular Age, he's a Canadian philosopher, he said, actually, in a metaphoric sense, we live in an age of excarnation. Not that we are literally defleshing ourselves, but he says that we live at a time where we are increasingly living in our heads or even outsourcing knowledge beyond our bodies. So we are defleshing our own experience. So he talked about this as being the full flowering of modernity. Have you heard the catchphrase of the Enlightenment, which is, I think, therefore I am? Are you familiar with that phrase? So the idea is your whole identity, your whole sense of personhood, you are the sum total of your thoughts. And so what Taylor said was hundreds and hundreds of years of that, generation after generation after generation of people presuming you are not your body, you are not what you do, You are not, you don't know yourself physically in place and in community. You think, therefore you are. After hundreds of years of that, we've become increasingly defleshed. We often talk about our bodies as they're just the thing that carries us around. We often have this highly dualistic kind of sense. Body, not so important. My thoughts, my spirit, my soul, my imagination, whatever language you use, that's actually me. And so what he's saying is that's excarnational. We are defleshing ourselves. And then a guy called Michael Pollyanni came along and said, you can see it in the way we learn stuff. Like, we used to learn things in an entirely embodied sense. Now, I'm going to share some gender stereotypical examples that come from his book, but he was writing a while ago, so forgive the gender stereotypes here. But he would say, young girls would learn to cook at their grandmother or their mother's elbow. Your grandmother or your mother would teach you how to make, you know, that cake or that meal or those scones or whatever the case may be. And no recipe was ever written down. And in fact, your mother or grandmother probably couldn't actually tell you how many mils of this or how many grams of that. All of it was known in your mother or your grandmother's body. It was a handful of this. It was a pinch of that. It was a drop of this. It was a glug of that. And then you taste, oh, another glug of this or a little bit more of that. Like, this was embodied knowledge. And the only way you learned Nana's, you know, scone recipe or what have you is to sit with her and watch her physically produce this meal. He goes on to say it's the same thing with the way young men would learn farming or building or how to be a handyman around the house. How do you learn this kind of stuff? Well, fathers would pass this knowledge on. And when you would say, how many mils should that be or how heavy should that piece of wood be? He'd be like, I don't know, like, let me just feel it for me to know. In fact, in that book, Pollyanni tells the story of Stradivari, who was the great violin maker. Have you heard of Stradivarius? Violins, they're like worth millions, like millions of dollars today. Stradivari was almost illiterate. He never wrote down any plans for how to make his violins. He would bring apprentices to his table, and he would take a piece of wood that he was going to create the violin out of, and he would weigh it in his hands. No. And then give it to his apprentice to weigh it. He doesn't know what he's weighing. It's just like, okay, that's not okay. Next bit of wood. Better, but no. Pass it on to the apprentice. Third piece of wood. Ah, perfect. Perfect balance. Exactly what we need. And he would pass it to the apprentice. The apprentice doesn't know what he's feeling. But after you've felt enough wrong pieces of wood and enough right pieces of wood, you start to feel it too. Where does the knowledge reside? In your fingers. Where does the knowledge for your nana's scones reside? On her tongue. Like, we embody these things. We know these things. And of course, Indigenous brothers and sisters can talk to us about the embodied sense of knowing and community and connection to country that very often those of us from white Anglo backgrounds, influenced much more by modernity, as Charles Taylor mentioned, have become increasingly excarnated, increasingly disconnected from realities or knowledge that is embodied and known in our flesh. Does this make sense? So what this does is it disconnects us from others. No longer do you need your nana to teach you that favourite recipe. No longer does your dad need to tell you how to do the handyman stuff around the home. How do you know how to do it? YouTube. Some disembodied person you don't know will tell you, but they won't weigh the wood in their hands. They will say, you need to have a piece of wood so many millimetres thick that should weigh so many grams. Like, it's all so perfect. Have you ever watched somebody cooking by recipe, either online or reading a recipe, and they go to pieces if they don't have three mils of this ingredient or that ingredient? Because there's no capacity for improvising. There's no reservoir of knowledge that we know in our bodies and in our taste buds that we can compensate for. We are completely outsourcing our knowledge. I think, therefore, I am. I know knowledge, which is now a reservoir for me externally from my body. I don't need to actually know it or feel it. You all with me?
Yeah.
Second idea I want to throw at you is this. It's an idea from Richard Sennett, which goes like this. That life, can we get the next slide? That life is chiefly like a gate lounge. Oh, that's not going to come up. Well, there's a picture of a gate lounge there anyway. Now, how many of you have ever spent any time in a gate lounge in an international or any airport? Right. So you tell me, what is life like in a gate lounge? Throw some ideas at me. Boring. It's not so boring like you're just like completely disconnected, just being bored. You're kind of a little on edge, actually, in a gate lounge, aren't you? Because you're not, you haven't left yet and you haven't arrived yet. Either it's the gate lounge you're going to leave from or it's the gate lounge you're in transit through. You're actually keyed up in a gate lounge. And you actually spend a lot of time looking at screens in a gate lounge. Have you noticed this? You're always checking if you're in the right gate lounge, always checking if your delayed flight is extra delayed. You're constantly on edge, just not super amped up, just a bit like on edge because this isn't home. This isn't where I'm meant to be and this is not where I'm going. Richard Sennett says this is a liminal experience. You haven't left and you haven't arrived. You're in this kind of liminal kind of space. It's hermetically sealed off from the rest of the world. It's air conditioned. I mean, have you ever flown through Dubai or Singapore and spent time in transit in one of those cities? It could be stinking hot outside. You have no clue, right? You don't know what it's like out there. You don't know anything about life in Singapore or Dubai. You are just passing through. You are hermetically sealed off from the environment. You are kind of on edge. You're not relaxed. You're not at home. You haven't left. You're kind of in this liminal kind of space. And Sennett says, actually, that's not a bad metaphor for describing what life is like in late modernity or at the turn of the 21st century. Because a lot of us live life like we're not actually where we're meant to be yet. We live life sealed off from our worlds around us. Increasingly, we're living our lives in homes that are air-conditioned. We're living lives in homes that have no front windows or doors. You've got to walk down the side to get in. You've got big double garage doors at the front. All the life is out the back, the swimming pool and the big sliding doors, and all the light is out there, but we on the street don't see it. You are sealed off from your neighbours and your neighbourhood. You get into air-conditioned cars. You drive to air-conditioned offices. There's that sense in which you are hermetically sealed away from the world of which you're part, but there's also this constant sense that you haven't made it yet. You haven't arrived. You're not at your destination yet. And so while this might be becoming increasingly difficult for emerging generations, for many of us who grew up at a time where you would grow up in this particular neighborhood, and then when you became an adult, you'd rent in this particular neighborhood. But when you're in this particular neighborhood and someone said, where are you from? You didn't say, I'm from here, this is where I live. You would say, I'm from where I grew up. You're not actually at where you grew up anymore, but you would say, well, I grew up in Caringbah, but I happen to be living here now. Your sense of home is Caringbah, but it's not your home anymore. And then the other thing, too, is that you would raise up a deposit and you'd buy a crummy apartment or a fixer-upper kind of house, and then you'd move to this place here. And someone would say, oh, where are you from? You wouldn't say, I'm from here. You'd say, well, actually, I'm from Caringbah. Although, before here, we used to live here. There's this sense in which you don't belong anywhere. And even if you've lived in a neighborhood for a long time like I have, my generation, when people ask you, where are you from? They often will say, well, what do you mean by that question? Where did I grow up or where do I live now? Or they'll say, yeah, I'm living such and such a place. Although we have been thinking of downsizing or as we get closer to retirement, we're wondering whether we should move. Like, no one's ever home. Everyone's always just a little keyed up thinking that there's something else, somewhere else. Now, the effect that that has, if you combine it with excarnation, is that you're living increasingly in your head or with information which is stored online, and you're not actually rooted or anchored in a particular place, committed to a particular group of people, to a neighborhood, to a village, to the topography of which you're part. What that does is it makes you increasingly Teflon-coated and resistant to connection with others and to place. Life in a gate lounge. Excarnation. The third idea I want to throw at you is Zygmunt Bauman's idea. Oh, sorry, just on life in a gate lounge. If you want to see a great movie about what this is about, it's an old movie now. It's a George Clooney movie called Up in the Air. And it is just a perfect, it's as if Richard Sennett could have written the script. Because George Clooney is an HR consultant. He flies all around America. He lives all of his life in airplanes and airports. He lands in particular cities, goes to offices, where as an HR consultant, he fires people and takes them through their severance packages. And in the film, he has learned, he's memorized all these empathic lines to say to people when they start crying or when they get angry or when they're worried about their aging father's, you know, who needs medical expenses to be covered. Like, he's actually memorized fake empathic lines. He's living his life up in the air, disconnected from anyone. And proud of it. If you watch the film, you'll see ultimately he comes unstuck as a result of that. So excarnation is the first idea. Life in the gate lounge is the second idea. The third idea, similar to the second idea, it's Zygmunt Bauman's idea that life is like tourism. That tourism is actually the best metaphor to describe modern life. Similar to the gate lounge one. But think a little bit about what life is like as a tourist. If you're a tourist, what is life like? If you've ever visited another country, been around Europe, visited New Zealand, been to America, how would you describe what the life of a tourist is like?
Carefree.
Carefree. I don't belong to anybody. I have no responsibilities. I'm on holidays. I'm a rolling stone. I'm completely disconnected. Yep, what else?
Light.
Light, yeah. I'm light. I'm floating through this particular place, yeah.
Out of place
where you don't belong.
Shallow?
Well, it's, well, yeah, what do you mean by that, Annie?
Go into culture, you're sitting
under, like, the
attention.
Right. I do know what you mean. So you're not actually going to go to Paris and live like a Parisian. You're not going to find out what the price of bread in Paris is, or, you know, what power bills are like in Paris, or how expensive education is in Paris, or whatever the case may be. No, you just want to get a photo of the Eiffel Tower. You're like, you want to be on that terrace where you can stand and do that, and it looks like you're holding the top of the Eiffel Tower. So it's a faux experience. And you say things like, oh, yeah, we've done Paris. Like, we did it. We did it because we ate a baguette and we, like, had a photo of the Eiffel Tower. So there is a shallowness as you bounce through that particular town or village. Anything else?
Enjoyable.
It's enjoyable, yeah. I mean, you're there to have fun. You're there to have those kind of ultimate sort of experiences. Exactly. And it can be adventurous. What's the other side of enjoyable? You could be confused, particularly where there's language barriers or cultural barriers. But the other side of enjoyment is you can be hypercritical about your experience, can't you? Because I went to this particular place to have this particular experience and it was rained out. Or I went all the way to Milford Sound and it was all foggy and rainy and I couldn't see anything. Don't worry about the fact that it's foggy and rainy at Milford Sound like 200 days of the year, and that's actually the experience of Milford Sound. You didn't get that perfect photo. So you become hypercritical of the food or hypercritical of the service in a certain country, or hypercritical because you have a sort of expectation of how enjoyable this will be, and if it doesn't live up to it, it really throws you. Now, what Bauman is saying is this. Think about all of that. And then ask yourself, how many people do you know who actually go through their ordinary life like that? Like bouncing over the top of life, not going deep, not engaging meaningfully in their neighborhood or with people or with causes or with concerns for other people. How many people do you know that are going through life hypercritically, judging everything because it's not perfect? I was meant to have a baby at this time of my life. I was meant to have had this promotion by this time of the life. Like, you are highly critical that your experience isn't as the brochure told you it ought to be. It's very self-focused. It's very disconnected. So Bauman's idea of us living like tourists, having faux experiences, unreal experiences, disconnected from our neighbourhood, is another addition to this idea of what it means to be distracted. Now think about these three ideas that we've put together already. You are excarnate. You are living chiefly in your head or even outsourcing your ideas beyond yourself. You are seeing life as a liminal experience, never being totally anchored or rooted or committed to a particular group of people or neighbourhood. Always feeling a little edgy and thinking there's got to be the next thing that I've got to get to. And that you're living life like a tourist, analysing whether your job lives up to the brochure, analysing whether your experience is as picture perfect as everyone promised you it would be, having a faux experience, play acting at living life without actually entering fully into the messiness and the dirtiness and the disappointment and the confusion that often comes with real life and real relationships and real connections. You're with me so far? And then the fourth idea, it's not really an idea, but it's just a statement of fact, and that is that we now find ourselves screen obsessed. Make sure that you look at those screens and write down your Slido questions as well. But we now find ourselves screen obsessed. That's the other thing that you find about people in gate lounges, isn't it? If they're not looking at the screen with the monitor with all the flights coming in and out, they're looking at the screen with CNN or sports on it, or they're looking at their own screens. All reality, it seems, is becoming increasingly mediated through screens, so that we're screen obsessed, but in some cases we find that we're screen addicted as well. We find that where we see the dopamine kind of hit that people get from the regular use of online pornography or gaming or social media, where it's an addiction. It's just an obsession. Like any lull in anything at any time, I go for my phone. Any kind of lull in conversation. Any TV show or movie I'm watching that's kind of just, you know, lost me for a little bit, up comes my phone. It's our go-to experience of how to engage with something that keeps me feeling like a tourist, keeps me feeling like things are enjoyable, keeps me unconnected from the things that are around me. Screens have become these ways in which we exacerbate all the things I've talked about. We become less embodied, we become less connected, and less anchored into place. There's a picture of an iguana on the screen because there's a really tragic novel by Russell Banks called The Lost Memory of Skin. It's a really devastating title, isn't it? The Lost Memory of Skin. But in this book, it's the story of a young man. He's called the Kid. He's never given a name. He'd been convicted of a child sex offence and been in prison. He's come out of prison. He has no friends. Everyone's rejected him because of his offence. His family have turned their back on him because of his offence. His only friend is his pet iguana called Iggy, and he lives with a homeless male community under a freeway overpass. It's a really cheery novel, as you can imagine. He's addicted to pornography. He's just chronically addicted to it, and the book kind of implies that his porn addiction actually has contributed to his deviant sexual practice. But there's this devastating line in the book where it says, the kid has seen every kind of sexual activity that human bodies are capable of, but he's a virgin and knows only the touch of an iguana's skin. Now, to me, this is kind of metaphoric, isn't it? That we know and see things far beyond our experience or our capacity, whether that's online pornography or whatever it might be, that we are actually entering into social media debates about things of which we have very limited understanding and almost no skin in the game. We are entering into game playing and gaining experiences far and away beyond anything that we've ever experienced in our real lives. That what we are doing is becoming increasingly excarnated and utterly distracted. So if you've ever read Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, he was a journalist who found that he couldn't finish reading a book, that he couldn't spend any more time than 10 to 15 minutes on a particular project at any given point in time. He'd start writing an article, then he'd have to check his phone to do something, and then he'd have to look at something on TV, and then go back to what he was doing, then back to the book that he was reading. And what he realized was that his attention span had become shorter and shorter as a result of his obsession with screens. So what does all this mean for us? What this means for us, folks, is that we live in an age which is increasingly excarnate. And for many people, they don't even think about that. Maybe you'd never thought about that before this day. Maybe you've never asked yourself, what do you know in your body? What do you know about your neighbourhood In what way have you had an enfleshed, embodied sense of connection to others? What do you know about the neighbourhood, the area? You live in a beautiful part of Sydney. There's rivers and coastlines and all that kind of stuff. To what degree do we actually have a sense of connection to place, to country? To what degree do we find ourselves so easily distracted and living in hermetically sealed kind of places, disconnected from the world around us and from each other, and yet at the same time, constantly talking and interacting with people through our screens? In what ways are we as Christians actually seeing it incumbent upon ourselves to say, wait a second, this is an issue of discipleship? Like, you've probably heard plenty of sermons, maybe not so much these days, but there used to be lots of sermons about use of alcohol or use of money or commitment to mission or to service for other people. But I think we also need lots of sermons as well, don't we, about what does it mean for us to actually steward our hearts and our minds and our bodies in an age of distraction. And there's all sorts of kind of simple and straightforward things that you can do around setting time limits on the use of screens, on never charging your phone in your bedroom at night, about having regular fasts from social media or gaming, about seeking help if you are addicted to pornography, about being open and vulnerable with each other about your use of phones and being held accountable to certain fasts or limits and the like. There are all those sorts of things that I think we ought to talk about regularly and put in place to help us to be enfleshed, embodied people. Because here's the thing about our God. When we want to think about God, he's not disembodied. God is not beyond and holy and ineffable only. Our God, and this is the very thing that Buddhists and that Muslims in particular are horrified by, our God has a body. Our God became flesh and dwelt among us. And he didn't leave that body behind when he returned to heaven. In the ascension, his body goes with him. Like, there's an extraordinary mystery to this, isn't there? That God takes on flesh and lives in flesh and remains in flesh even through the resurrection and the ascension. And in that respect, while you never had to preach this sermon 100 years ago or 200 years or 500 years ago, today we do need to be reminded again and again and again, what does it mean for us to see ourselves as embodied people, enfleshed people in place, on country and connected to that as an act of discipleship? How can I free myself from only living in my head or only living online? How can I learn something by being at the shoulder of someone? How can I learn how to make a violin by actually having a master pass the piece of wood to me? How do I discover knowledge in my fingertips? How do I learn what it is to embody my faith? What does it mean for me to eat the gospel? Do you know that one of the things Jesus told his disciples to do was not to sing or listen to sermons or sit in rows? You know what he said? Whenever you meet together, here's what I want you to do. Eat and drink. Our primary act of worship is meant to be an embodied activity. Like, I don't know how often you do communion, but lots of churches do it very rarely. Our churches are becoming excarnate. You can sit in a row there and you can think about God and you can think about the words of the song and your whole sense of God can be lifted there. We don't even connect with each other. And neither do we taste and eat and experience physically what it is to be an embodied follower of Jesus. And yet it was the table in the first few centuries that turned the Roman Empire upside down. That was a time where people were talking about these mysterious religions and all these kind of spooky, well, we would say new agey ways of connecting to God or the gods. And then this group of people called the Christians turned up, and you know what their gatherings were like? They sat around tables. They ate meat. They ate bread. They drank wine. And they would call to strangers walking by, join us, have you prepared your evening meal? Come on, eat our food, drink our wine. All are welcome, slaves and free, men, women, rich, poor, all were welcome at that place. So that when you as a passerby would see a courtyard filled with people sitting around a table, breaking bread in the name of Jesus, drinking wine as symbolic of his blood, and you would say, who are you people? What are you doing? And then you would look at it and you would say, aren't you a slave? Why are you sitting next to a free person? Aren't you a woman? Why are you doing all the talking? Aren't you a poor person? Aren't you a foreigner? Why are all of you accessed here? Why are you all engaged and all making a contribution? Some speaking in tongues, some interpreting the tongue, some leading a song, some bringing a message. Like, how does this work? Who are you? Because our faith was embodied faith. Our faith was lived in our bodies. It was eaten and tasted and experienced. Come to our table, they would say. Jesus is here. This place where two or three of us gather, we believe Jesus is here. Where other people, they might break bread or pour out wine as an offering, hoping their God up there might hear them. But we do this because we know our Jesus has a body, and our Jesus is very present whenever two or three of us gather. So friends, I think our worship needs to become more embodied. I think our ways of doing discipleship need to be more embodied. I think we need to hold each other more accountable to our use of screens, to our embodied sense of connection to neighborhood, to actual neighbors, to living lifestyles that are much more open and engaged, to connecting more to land, to sea, to river, to understanding the ecological responsibility we have for this land in which God has placed us, for justice, for those who are considered immigrant or outsider, and for those who have been stewarding this land for thousands of years. Why? Because that's kind of woke? Because that's kind of lefty and cool these days? No, because that's what enfleshed people do. Put your veranda on the front of your house. Live out the front. Open your home to tables. Orient your lifestyles around the kind of values that connect to people. Invite them to join you. Partner with them in projects that they can share with you on sorts of things, rather than just saying, would you like to come to church on Sunday? We are to be the most enfleshed and embodied people. And I understand it's really super, super hard in an age of excarnation, in an age where everyone is pushing us toward living as though we're in a gate lounge or we're just tourists wandering through this world trying to suck up as much experience as we can for our own sense of pleasure. No, friends, I want you to show people when they say, oh, where do you come from? That you can say, right here. Right here next to that person and that person, across the road from that person. Right here on this land. Right here in this place, among these people, in this particular locality. I'm called to be an incarnational presence of Jesus. Do you follow? In an age of distraction, it is a countercultural measure to seek to live in this way. Let me say a prayer. Father, we're going to have a panel in a minute, Lord, and I just pray that as we talk through how this would work and what this would look like, you'd help to direct our thoughts and our responses. And you'd help people to really gain a sense of how we might actually put into practice what it means to be your embodied, sent people in place, on country, in community, enfleshed, living out justice and peace and mercy and joy right under the noses of those who have not yet been set free. In Jesus' name, amen.